This is Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A native of Gary has spent some time away from home. Now he's come back to his hometown to take a close look of the city of Gary in a documentary that has come out about his hometown of Gary. Chris Robinson is with us. And Chris,
how
thanks
you
for I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio. Tell us first about yourself, about your interest in journalism, and particularly your early interest, I understand, in learning how to be a good storyteller.
Okay, sounds good. So thank you for having me again. I'm Chris Robinson. I'm 23 years old. I was born in Gary, Indiana. I went to Westside High School, where I graduated from in 2016. From there, I went on to Morehouse College, where I studied English and journalism. And that's where I truly noticed that, you know, I had a passion and an interest for storytelling. As a child and growing up, I spent some time at Bishop Nove, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And I remember there's when I had my first interest writing for the Journal, which is the Bishop Nove Institute, kind of newsletter. And then we also did, I was a football player, so in my off season, I would help out the basketball team and do coverage on the games. So that's when I originally first noticed that I had an interest for storytelling and just, you know, being on the journalism side of things as a career other than, well, at the time, you know, I was just kind of focused on sports. So I guess that was like, wow, this is, you know, kind of really what I want to do in life. So when I got to Morehouse, I kind of kept with it. I took a lot of journalism classes, of course, just learning a lot of different styles, anything from APA writing to, you know, production skills or being on a newsroom. So just, you know, learning all of those things and seeing all the things in Atlanta like TNT and just really learning that the opportunities were limitless for journalists in this world.
I know you do a lot of multimedia journalism now. Did your start in journalism at Morehead kind of get you interested into that and you worked your way into the other media that's out there besides just print?
Yeah, at Morehouse, I definitely would get my start with the Maroon Tiger, I would say, in digital media. The Maroon Tiger was our media outlet, basically, when we had print, online, social media, and that's where they were, you know, really my interest there was. I became interested in interviews, and just, we would had a YouTube channel, so we would, you know, do interviews with other students, kind of like, I don't want to say campus celebrities, but people who were kind of, you know, had a good name on campus,
right,
and could get us some good views. So, you know, we would tell their stories. And, you know, I had a lot of great professors. And also I was a member of the National Black Journalism Association. And, you know, that was an outstanding opportunity, going to their conferences and working with other black journalists, just learning more about storytelling and telling these stories about our communities that need to be told.
Did you have any mentors or any people that you looked up to while you were still in college and your association with the Black Journalists Association?
Yeah, definitely. Ron Thomas was my college advisor and mentor. He's a great guy. He was a big-time reporter in Oakland for most of his career in journalism. But he's a huge journalist. If you guys want to look him up, I'm not sure if anybody's like big on journalism. But Ron Thomas, he was one of my advisors and mentors. And then in the area of Midwest, Northwest Indiana, to Daryl Digpen, also helped me out a lot within the last year, just kind of adjusting to the undergrad or after the undergrad life as a freelancer, rather. So, yeah, and then also one more guy, Trevor Kane, helped me a lot with my film and just kind of setting the blueprint for starting my production company, my enterprise, and just working for that, working kind of for myself. Trevor helped me a lot with that. So he's been great in the past year.
Okay, let's talk about the film. Let's talk about Looted, which is the documentary about your hometown of Gary. If you will, first tell us some general facts, things that you've learned, certainly from school, but from real life, from living in Gary, about how the city changed over the time and what, unfortunately, it led to the incidents of looting in Gary.
Yeah, I would say one of the most interesting facts. There's a bunch of facts, I promise, in the documentary. But one of the most that I would say growing up, I was always interested to know why did Gary and Maryville kind of happen. From my understanding, when I was a child, you know, we all knew that Gary or Maryville was once Gary. So growing up and actually doing research for my documentary and finding out that the state of Indiana made a buffer zone law, or they made the buffer zone law exempt in Maryville, which means that, so basically in Indiana, the buffer zone law means that you can't build a city outside of a city within 3 or 15 miles if it's already like a not a rural city. So they made an exemption for Maryville because it was a rural city, and that then led it to commercial businesses, more residents, and all types of things. You know, Maryville's been around for about 40 years now as a town. So, you know, it was just kind of interesting to see how that actually happened and how, you know, Gary actually gave up half of their land almost of South County to start another town in Indiana. So, you know, that was very interesting. And to only figure out that it happened right here in Gary was kind of very interesting.
You mentioned some interesting facts that maybe some people know from school or from their own studies about the fact that that the peak population in Gary back in the 1960s was pretty high. It was 178,000. Yeah. That's a respectably sized city. Cities that size in Indiana today would be considered pretty big. But that changed a lot for the many reasons that I know that you mentioned in the documentary, Looted. But tell us a little bit more about what you learned in that respect and how that's all fit in together in the film.
Yeah, so personally, I had a call coming in. Personally, you know, I have a lot of educators in my family, and I know that, so as an English major, a lot of people looked at me to kind of go into the education field, but I had other plans, of course. But a lot of people in my family became educators, and I respect the career because, you know, to work with kids or to be a teacher is just a job that, you know, is not for everybody, or it's truly a tasking one. So when I learned that most people came to Gary to actually become teachers or to work in the education field, you know, I was just astonished because I didn't really know that. And then also the steel mill, which was the job for most people at the time. You know, you were either, if you were college educated, you would become maybe a teacher or a pastor. If you were, you know, a regular working class guy, the steel mill was open and everybody can get a job. But now, you know, neither one of those options are here for the youth in Gary right now. You know, even if I was to come home and teach, I wouldn't, you know, really have a teaching opportunity, I don't think, in Gary. Or, you know, most of my friends who became welders or stuff, they have to go to Chicago to find good work now. So it's just like, you know, the opportunities in the city have become very limited to none. And we got to do something about that and, you know, start making these changes and start having these conversations about what we can do.
I know that you've certainly learned over your lifetime so far and seen the changes in business and industry, besides industry, but in just the businesses in Gary, about how downtown Gary used to be a huge, thriving place. People from South Lake County would come to Gary to shop. They'd come up to Sears and to the other stores there on Broadway.
It's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, and you probably made note of that, I'm sure, in the film about the decline of business all tied together because of the decline in steel mills. What would you say that in the documentary Looted that you have out there that can be viewed and probably available for anybody to look into more depth that you think were some of the key points that you wanted to make about the changes not only in business and industry but also in the racial makeup and interests in Gary?
Well, yeah, I would say just, you know, that these issues have been existing or they have been at, you know, trouble for our communities for over 20 to 40 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now it's time. It's all about identifying those issues, figuring out what we can do, and making action. So whether, you know, those are racial issues that we may face from the state of Indiana, if those are, you know, educational issues that the school system are facing, you know, we need to create more jobs. All of those things can happen, you know, within the next 10 years. And Gary can become a very nice city.
You came up with the title Looted. Was that a reference to some of the unrest that happened in Gary and other similar cities in Indiana and the nation at the time that there was so much unrest, I guess, about not only about racial issues, but economic issues, too?
Yeah, so you're 100% right. The name Looted did come from the time last year around this time, which is actually when I started. And I was driving down Gary, and what I kind of noticed is that, you know, our community had truly been looted. You know, when you looked at the news and when you looked at, or if you were at a riot or something and you saw, you know, the unrest and you saw the buildings that were torn down or burning or had holes in them. And then you would come to Gary a week later, you would say, oh, this is the same thing. But, you know, for citizens in Gary, this is everyday life. For someone who was a member at the riots or a member that night, you know, this is, they're going to clean this up in the morning. But for Gary, this is every day. This is what our citizens are faced with. So that's why we're looted.
Chris Robinson, if you will spend a little time telling us about how you put this thing together, this documentary. I think most people consider documentaries maybe not necessarily the exclusive domain of people like Ken Burns, but a lot of people like Ken Burns have put together similar documentaries. What did you do as a budding documentarian to get this particular project going?
I had a teacher, another one of my great mentors, Mickey Harris, and she told me, you know, when you're not doing anything, that's when you can do the most. So I was just thinking at the time, I was freshly out of college, freshly out of undergrad, and kind of what I wanted to do, you know, was just kind of my own thing, or what I wanted to do was, you know, something that I couldn't do for anybody else and what I can do for myself. And a lot of people, I guess, had an expectation of me to kind of help the city of Gary, or not even like an expectation, just some of my friends generally thought that, you know, I would come back and do things in the city right away. Not saying that I won't do things in the city, but Looted is something that I can do for the city right now. When I look at my time and my talents and, you know, what I can actually do as far as the infrastructure that I do have now, Looted is exactly, you know, what can be done and exactly what's happening to, you know, start these conversations. So when we talk about actually putting together the documentary, I literally, you know, started, it was during the coronavirus pandemic. So I remember the first guy I talked to, we were kind of sitting 6 feet away from each other in the room. But we were talking just a casual conversation about Gary. And, you know, this is just a citizen who was on the fire department at one time. So, you know, not anybody of, you know, too much notoriety, or, but at the same time, still a, you know, a respected citizen. And I remember I just began to pull out my notepad and take notes. And then from there, you know, put together a template. And, you know, it's just a snowball effect. Like, okay, I have this information. Where do I go from here? And I didn't know much about making documentaries. Like you said, I'm no Ken Burns, but I knew that, you know, it can be done. So, you know, just like I said, snowball affecting it every time. And I was still back and forth from Atlanta to Gary. So, you know, coming home for a week and a half to work, coming home. And then I actually came home once to bring some friends from Atlanta who worked with my production company. And, you know, we actually got started on the interviews. You know, when we had a full week of interviews, you know, 5 people a day, we did 21 interviews for this documentary. So, you know, it was really a process, and I love to watch the process. I'm still trusting the process, and I'm hoping that, you know, there will be a lot to reap.
What kind of research did you get to do? What places for research information did you get to raid to be able to put everything together that will go into the documentary that people will see?
Yeah, the best research was talking to people. You know, there's plenty of information on Gary on the internet. There's plenty of books about Gary. Also, John Trafany, he has a series of books. He's one of my teachers at Bishop Knowles. I finally buckled down and purchased his books and read them. And he has they're actually just photojournalist books, and they tell stories through the photos. So, about this, and it's kind of where I got the timeline for my documentary from, because his books start around the early 30s, but I picked up in the 60s. And, you know, he just tells a story from, like, what schools look like around the time. Steel mills, people going to work, and they're just photojournalism books, and they're awesome. So that helped me, like, give a timeline and a kind of structure to the documentary. But just anything else, I would say, as far as research, really came from talking to citizens and really the people, you know, who say, hey, man, I can tell you this, but I don't want my story told. You know, people like that have the best stories, or people who, you know, will tell a story and they don't care because they've known the story for 40 years and, you know, now it's time to actually tell it. So those type of stories are the best stories and make the best for visual storytelling.
Well, it sounds like that those are the stories that will definitely be the ones to wait to listen to see when you get to have a chance to see the documentary about the city of Gary called Looted. And it's been put together by Gary native and a Morehouse graduate, Chris Robinson. By the way, the premiere of the documentary is going to happen on Sunday, the 27th at 4:00 in the afternoon. And it'll be presented at the Art House, the Social Kitchen on Fifth Avenue in Gary. So I suppose that if nobody wants to go to a baseball game across the street, they ought to come over and watch the documentary, I suppose.
Yeah, there are a few tickets left. What I will say is if you are interested and you can't make it to the premiere, the movie will be available same day on my website, which is www.chrisprobinson.us /looted for the Looted page. But feel free to check out the website. You can check out a lot of other things I worked on. Check out this project and plenty of other multimedia journals. I have a couple articles up and everything. So
Well, Chris, thank you for spending time talking about your latest work, a documentary about your hometown of Gary called Looted. Chris Robinson is a student in film and another journalism and photojournalism, as well as being a native of Gary. Thank you for being with us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, veterans often cite the GI Bill as the number one reason that they joined the military, and it is now the 77th anniversary of a landmark benefit that has probably been the single most important feature of military service that seems to have transformed lives of veterans and their families, and they can still take advantage of it in its newest form today. In fact, there's been some significant changes made recently to the GI Bill, which means it's very good news for veterans and for service members and their families. With us to talk about it is Charmaine Boak. She is the Executive Director of Education Services for the Department of Veterans Affairs in Washington. And Charmaine, thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, how long has the VA education benefits been around, and what kind of impact has it really had on veterans and their families?
It's been around for 77 years. We just celebrated the 77th anniversary on June 22nd. When you think about 77 years ago, it actually started out just as a monthly stipend. And when you fast forward today and 25 million individuals who have been benefited from this program, it has expanded beyond that monthly stipend to help individuals achieve their educational goals. Today, we can pay the full gamut. There's over 400,000 VA-approved programs, and there's over 20,000 VA educational institutions that are in our space that any one of our veterans, service members, or family members can take full advantage of.
Now, I know that if you asked an average person what the GI Bill is all about, they would say about educating veterans, being able to pay for expenses and the like. Is that the main purpose or one of the purposes of the GI Bill? And how many veterans are being served every year by the VA because of it?
I will tell you, in my mind, it's threefold. One, it is a tool and an avenue to help enhance the lives of our veterans and service members and their family members. But also, it is a way to basically to help this nation's economy, right? It has been a force to be reckoned with in terms of helping the workforce, getting folks back into the workforce and contributing back to our society as a whole. And then lastly, it definitely has expanded the opportunities that's available to individuals that this program is afforded to for individuals under this program. I will tell you, like I said, it's not just about two-year or four-year schools. We have on-the-job training programs, apprenticeship programs. We have the full gamut of programs that are available to our students to take full advantage of. So I want folks to think more than just an education benefit for a veteran service member or their family member, but how it has contributed to our nation as a whole.
I'll go into some more of the newer programs, the upgraded programs, I'm sure, but can you tell us first, how has the VA been able to support students during the COVID pandemic?
Yes, so early last year in 2020, we saw the effects of the pandemic hit our educational institutions. Several schools started to reach out across this nation to say that they planned on closing their campus locations and providing training in an online fashion. So we really had to work with advocacy groups and other stakeholders to ensure that we could protect our students and protect their benefits and make sure they can continue their education programs uninterrupted. So we were able to work with congressional members to pass legislation as well as make policy changes to protect individuals' monthly housing allowance, to protect their entitlement if their school closed down, and to also protect individuals such as our work-study students where their sites closed down. And if schools, and also to extend benefits if needed for when individuals were planned on returning back to school because they were affected by COVID. And most recently, in the American Rescue Plan, Congress passed, basically there's a provision in there where we created a new program, the Veterans Rapid Retraining Assistance Program. That is to help unemployed veterans who were impacted by COVID to get trained up quickly and get back into the workforce. Pandemic has really changed the job market, and we're trying to make sure we keep up with those trends, and we try to help our unemployed veterans get back into the workforce.
I know that the GI Bill has gone through a number of transformations. Of course, the original GI Bill after World War II ended, veterans coming out of that war got a chance to go to college. Add on the fact that students in college at the time, like myself, got to take advantage of the original GI Bill, or what it was about 20 years after the war. And then, of course, we had the changes as well, too. My brother, younger brother, got to go through under the Montgomery GI Bill. And now we have not only the post 9/11 GI Bill, but we also have now a digital GI Bill. Will you tell us more about how the upgrades in technology and all, especially the digital GI Bill, is helping veterans these days and trying to reach their academic goals?
Yeah, so the digital GI Bill really is to help all our education programs in our space. Montgomery GI Bill program is still around, I'll tell you. The majority of our folks do leverage post 9/11 GI Bill because it is the most robust and generous package that's out there. But we actually have 5 education programs in our space. And with digital GI Bill in particular, it really is to help with our interactions with our student veterans and our school officials and other stakeholders. It's to help to make sure that we can have quick turnaround times to make sure students understand what they're eligible for, also to make sure we're getting timely benefits out the door, more self-service options for our students. We hear it from them every day. Hey, VA, send us an email, text message us. We're not waiting for a letter to come in the mail from you all. So we are working on those things. And then also more robust analytics capability to be able to tell the story of GI Bill. It's been around for 77 years. It's had so much impact to our nation, and it's important for us to keep up with the trends of what we're seeing across our nation so we can continue to expand the GI Bill to help our service members as they transition back to civilian life.
I know that you keep a very close eye on the 5 education benefit programs within the VA, and you probably get to see the real effect, the multiplying effect of the benefits that come when each time the GI Bill gets changed.
Yes, we do. I will say we service nearly 1 million individuals each year in our program and pay out $11 billion. But as it relates to how many doctors, lawyers, teachers, you know, healthcare professionals that basically have been trained under GI Bill is vast and wide. And we want to continue to keep that up so we can not only help our service members to integrate back in, but also help this nation to thrive.
Is that one good reason why we should support all of these amazing programs like those?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our individuals went into the military to serve. They served this nation, and it's important for us to take care of them. And it's just a life cycle, right, in terms of we take care of them, they take care of us, and it takes care of the nation as a whole.
Now, let me ask, where can veterans go if they need assistance, if they haven't been able to take advantage of, for whatever reason, of the GI Bill that they may have earned in benefits, or get more information about their benefits? Where can they turn?
For more information, they can actually reach out to us at our website at www.benefits.va.gov/GI Bill, or call our dedicated education call center at 1-888-GI-BILL-1.
Charmaine Bogue is the Executive Director for Education Services for the Department of Veterans Affairs in Washington, D.C., and she gets to show some strategic direction to more than 2,000 employees in education all across the country that in turn will help veterans and their families get better educations and a better life as well. Charmaine, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it, Chris.
This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio, which of course means we have an opportunity to talk to reporters in Northwest Indiana media about the stories they've put out in print and online. And today it's the business scene with Joseph Pete, who's a Times business reporter as well as an author. We'll stick that in there too, Joe. We can't let people forget about that. Thank you for being with us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, one of the stories you had out there in print and online is another, in fact, the latest breaking news story, so to speak, of the saga involving Franciscan Health Hammond. Will you bring us up to date the latest information that the healthcare providers put out to the state and the impact of that?
Yes. Unfortunately, the Franciscan Health had warned the state of Indiana, the Department of Workforce Development, through a warrant or Workers Adjustment and Retraining Notice Act, that it's going to be laying off 83 workers from the hospital in downtown Hammond as part of its shrinking the footprint there. They're giving a lot of the people opportunities to transfer because they're going to be bulking up some of the operations in Dyer and Munster when they cut back on surgery and inpatient admissions at the downtown Hammond Hospital. Has kind of been an anchor and an institution there for more than 120 years. But they are, and, you know, they're still going to continue to offer multiple services there. But it's shrinking from around like 260 beds or so to only about 8. So it's going to be a massive scaling back. They did, you know, they're trying to transfer as many workers as possible. And then there are about 700 physicians that are affiliated with the hospital. But a lot of those physicians are in the Franciscan Network system, and they weren't necessarily bound just to that hospital. They also had, you know, they also had offices in, you know, the other hospitals Franciscan maintains across the region. But unfortunately, 83 people will be losing their jobs. They did not outline, you know, what positions or where, but it's going to be an extensive cutback to the, they're going to put $46 million into the downsizing of the campus. They're going to demolish most of the older parts of the building. It's currently 8 or 9 stories. It's going to be just a much smaller, more scale back, more modest, because their Times newsroom is right across from their hospital in Munster, and it's the more modern, more recently constructed one. Driving by, you know, you wouldn't even know it's a hospital. It doesn't have that, like, imposing facade of the way, you know, the community health hospital does in Munster, or the Franciscan does, or St. Catherine's, or any Chicago, or any of the older hospitals, because it's just a much more modest scale architecturally. But, yeah, unfortunately, more than 80 people are going to be losing their jobs. Obviously, this hasn't sat well with a lot of a lot of people have expressed outrage and frustration over this move, including multiple civic leaders, not just in Hammond, but this has been the main hospital for a lot of the Illinois communities, you know, Calumet City, Burnham. When they did that protest rally, a lot of the civic leaders from there turned out, because it's kind of the main hospital for right there along the border for people in Indiana and Illinois for, you know, more than a century.
I think that the official notice, the WARN notice, as it's called, that was sent from the hospital to the state of Indiana, is a very simple, very direct, very short message. They all seem to pretty much look the same. It's like they take a template from the state Department of Workforce Development, and they just plug in names and information, and that's about it. And the short notice in its own right does not even begin to reveal what kind of impact that the start of the employees that are going to be leaving Franciscan Health Hammond is going to show.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, the separations are going to start in August 21st, and they're going to, you know, between the summer and the fall, they're going to start to wind down, you know, greatly shrink the operations there. It's going to have major ramifications for, you know, obviously the people's jobs will be lost, but also for downtown Hammond, a lot of the businesses and so forth, because for a long time, you know, a lot of the department stores and retail left, the movie palaces left, a lot of the activity in downtown Hammond left, but one of the, you know, the courthouse, you have the courthouses and the attorneys, but now a lot of the attorneys, you know, you still have some that maintain offices there, but it's not even the legal hub it was. More people maintain offices elsewhere or travel. However, the there are multiple other, you know, superior courts and so forth throughout the Northwest Indiana, Gary, Crown Point, Valpo, and so forth. But the it's going to have an impact on all those businesses in the area. You know, a lot of those, the restaurants and so forth, depend on that hospital crowd for lunch, you know, lunch traffic and a lot of the traffic. And it's going to just greatly impact a lot of there will be definite ripple effects, because it's going to affect a lot of the business owners in the downtown when, you know, you just don't have as many people working there. Because it's not only the people are going to lose their jobs, but a lot of the existing workers are going to be transferred to the more suburban sites where Franciscan has chosen to focus its care at Dyer and Munster. But this is part of an ongoing trend that was exacerbated by the pandemic. You've seen a lot of the push in healthcare for years now, and not just in this area, has been less of a focus on traditional inpatient care to more of a focus on, you know, outpatient care, and particularly bring a lot of care, like quicker serve, like medical offices, like express clinics and those types of things to kind of suburban sites closer to where the patients live. But one big thing that happened during the pandemic is they switched to, you know, they often did like remote and virtual appointments. And then they started doing home monitoring for a lot of patients because, you know, they weren't able, they were concerned about infection and so forth. So it helped kind of accelerate the trend away from, it's very costly to keep patients overnight at the hospital. So more, and you know, the hospital and healthcare systems don't always get reimbursed in full from the insurance companies. So more and more there's been a push to, you know, move away from the traditional hospitalization method and leave people to either recover at home or just a general focus on more preventative care, you know, rather than reactive. Because it's the, you know, there are 260 or so beds in there, but typically Franciscan was only keeping 50. You know, the average head count on any given night was about 50 or 60 patients. However, they're going to be scaled back far below that, so the patients are going to get rerouted to, you know, there are other facilities in Munster, Dyer. There's that new physician-owned hospital by the Cabela's that also has a small emergency room. I imagine they'll probably be in habits. They'll probably be picking up some of the business, but they're not nearly large enough to, you know, handle all of the, you know, the lost
care. One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online, another major story that was in the Times, talks about some work that you did in reviewing a probably a very dry report from the federal government talking about home prices. And the fact that the headline says, Northwest Indiana saw one of the biggest jumps in home prices nationally last year. Tell us more about the information that you got out of that report and what kind of impact here in Northwest Indiana it's going to have.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the housing market has been pretty hot in Northwest Indiana for some time now, as anyone who has been on the market can attest. There is, it, according to the federal data, you know, we already had some of the data of, you know, what we saw the residential real estate market last year, but it was Northwest Indiana ranked 38th nationally, which is pretty high, the Gary Metro, just behind Indianapolis nationwide. Because you know a lot of the ones that are the highest ranking, you know, it's harder for more established markets like Chicago or Boston or you know Miami or whatever to largely built out. So you see kind of a lot of the faster going ones like Austin and Salt Lake City and Phoenix and a lot of the Knoxville and some of the Sun Belt communities with the fastest growing with the home value appreciation. But it shot up 13.8% year over year in the Northwest Indiana, the Gary Metro, which encompasses most of it. There's been a 40% increase in home values in Northwest Indiana since 2007, which is pretty substantial. The Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors report, you know, we're continuing to see a very hot and competitive market with limited inventory. You know, we previously saw records in home sales in like 2006 to 2007, right before the bubble burst, but they were selling around. It was like around 11,000 homes a year, I believe, and that was with 6,000 homes on the inventory at any given time. Over the past year, they've been selling, you know, more than a thousand homes, more than during the peak of 2007, but there have only been about 1,000 houses on the market at any given time. The home builders have not been able to build houses fast enough to keep up with the demand. In our area, this is the way it generally is nationally, but in our area, it's particularly exacerbated because you continue to see people migrating away from Illinois. It's often, an affordability issue. It's either, you know, homes are more expensive there. There's also the fiscal issues with taxes and so forth. But you just generally see the migration, particularly from the south suburbs of Chicago, over to Northwest Indiana. Yeah. That's really spiked the demand. You see that property just opened there. It's the largest residential real estate company in Chicago, and they just opened their third Northwest Indiana office of the year in Valparaiso. They had a ribbon cutting this past week. They've also opened in Crown Point at Cherryville because the market here is so hot. But the they had previously, you know, they're the largest market share in New Buffalo. They previously had a presence in like Long Beach and Michigan City, but they're focused on kind of the secondary summer homes. A lot of Chicagoans maintained where, you know, they might go out there for a few weekends to enjoy the beach or whatever a year. But now they're focusing on the primary market in Northwest Indiana because the demand is so strong. And they're also, they also mentioned, because they represent a lot of, you know, Chicago people are selling their homes. And since a lot of them are moving out this way, it makes sense for them to maintain a presence in both states. But the, yeah, the Chicago metro as a whole, of which Northwest is a part, was just 90th nationwide with 9.6% growth in home prices last year. But it's just been a very strong market. They've been reporting, you know, typically most houses will get multiple demands, right, or multiple offers right now. A lot of times they'll sell for more than the asking price. Homes are not on the market for very long. It's very competitive. I've heard there's been a disadvantage for veteran home buyers right now because they the VA loans are perceived as taking longer. So typically, a lot of the sellers will opt for, you know, conventionally financed loans instead because they have a number of options to choose from. But the homes are going off the market pretty fast in Northwest Indiana right now. It's been a very strong market.
You mentioned in your story about the fact that it is definitely a seller's market, and you mentioned also as well too in talking to some of the other realtors outside of Lake County in particular, in Porter and in LaPorte counties, about the fact that there are more houses that if they're out there for very long, which apparently they aren't, that it's just this opportunity for folks that want to move into Indiana to take over some of these houses, to be sure. One of the other stories I wanted to ask about, because it has an impact, I suppose, more on businesses than it probably has on persons, but it's a short story I know that came out, I think, first in some of the trade journals about what the federal government would like to know from citizens and businesses, I'm sure, about a very quietly proposed mega merger of two railroad lines. Will you tell, and one, of course, is a major line here in Northwest Indiana. Will you tell us more about this this proposed mega merger with Canadian National and the Kansas City Southern?
Oh, yes. There's been a lot of interest in the railroad community over this. Obviously, we're a pretty big rail hub in this area, as anyone who's had to wait behind a train can attest. It's largely due to all the rail that passes through Chicago with their strategic location south of Lake Michigan, all the major rail lines that crisscross the country typically have like some form of presence here. And then one of the largest rail companies in North America, CN, they have a pretty big presence locally. They maintain the Kirkyard in downtown Gary. They, you know, you see the trains everywhere, obviously. They're also at Barcombe, and they have other, you know, local facilities across Northwest Indiana, the south suburbs. But they outbid a rival, and they're looking to acquire Kansas City Southern, which is a rail line that focuses mainly on the southern United States and Mexico. And but they have this merger. It's a significant local a significant local operation. But this is potentially like having a major impact, this merger that they're talking about, because it would basically expand CN's footprint across North America to where they would be able to, you know, ship goods directly from Canada to Mexico or from across the United States. It would just give them a footprint across all of North America. And they've been touting this as potentially a way to realize the full benefits of the new North American trade agreement between Canada and the United States and Mexico. But as we've seen from past trade deals and so forth, such as NAFTA, you know, that can often have an impact on American manufacturing. You can see, something like the, for instance, automotive production. Currently, Ford, for instance, is only really making higher margin SUVs and pickup trucks to the United States because they're so profitable. You know, they have such a strong selling price. And then all the compact cars, well, it stays out a lot from the fleet, but then, you know, a lot of that is now being manufactured in Mexico or somewhere where production costs are cheaper. And you've seen, you know, you just need a lot of outsourcing and so forth. And there, you know, some observers have kind of been concerned that, you know, this could potentially, you know, possibly lead to increased foreign competition for, you know, American manufacturing and possibly, you know, some of the, with the trade, we could possibly see some of the loss of jobs. It's like the steel industry, for instance, has been suffering for decades now because of the imports from cheaper steel from, you know, all over the world. But we continue. It's, you know, we finally had some relief recently with the consolidation with Cleveland-Cliffs, and steel prices are strong and the companies are profitable right now. But for as long, years and years, as long as I've been covering the industry, there have often just been layoffs and mill idling. Chicago Tin is still idle. You know, it's been very difficult because, you know, a lot of the, you know, if they can't, with the steel in particular, like if they can't sell it in the domestic market, they'll dump it here at a loss to gain long-term market share. It's just been very difficult with a lot of the, you know, increased foreign competition because the United States has one of the most sort of loose trade policies. A lot of these other countries are far more aggressive about maintaining their own domestic, you know, manufacturing operations, but the U.S. is pretty welcoming to imports, and so it's had a devastating impact on manufacturing over the years. And it's, we've been particularly felt in this area because obviously we're a very big kind of manufacturing hub, particularly in steel. But it all we make so many different things here, from cardboard boxes to, you know, gummy bears to, you know, automotive parts. And it's just we're a very manufacturing intensive area, and you know, anything like this has the potential to have long term ramifications.
Well, Joe, we only have maybe about a minute or so left here in our conversation today, but we can't go without talking about Pierogi Fest because we know that it's going to be the next really, really big event coming up here in Northwest Indiana in July, and it's going to take a little, at least the parade's going to take a little different route this year. Will you tell us what the folks with the Hammond Roberts, with the Robertsdale Whiting Chamber of Commerce have to say about that?
Yes, they're scaling back the... the festival a little bit to kind of encourage more social distancing. They're going to have fewer food vendors and that type of thing, so there could be more spaced out. But perhaps, like, one of the biggest and most dramatic changes they're making, at least for this year, is the Pierogi Fest Polka Parade is the big kickoff to the event. And typically, it goes from Robertsdale down 119th Street all the way to, you know, through the downtown Whiting, where the festival itself, like, largely takes place. This year, it's going to go from Forsyth Park and Robertsdale to kind of just by the gates, just west of the gates to the actual festival, and it's going to stop short of going into 119th Street in downtown Whiting. Mm-hmm. So you'll still be able to see Mr. Pierogi and, you know, Miss Punchkey and the Lawnmower Precision Team. And they build that there's going to be a flyover of invisible UFOs from the planet Centauri, Proxima Centauri, which is actually a star, but I guess according to the Pierogi Fest scientists, it's a planet now. But they, it's going to, you know, all the wackiness and hijinks will ensue, but it's going to be taking place entirely in Robertsdale, and they're not going to be passing through, just to kind of encourage a little bit more you know, social distancing as we, you know, emerge from the pandemic.
I noticed that you had a nice quote from the chairman of the event, Tom Dabberton, that citizens can just have to deal with the changes, at least this year anyway. So it, I thought it was an interesting quote about if you're not happy with it, with the change in the route, just blame COVID-19 for it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, their press releases are always humorous. They're packed with jokes, much like the festival itself. And they are seeking people to march in the parade this year. If you're willing to dress up or decorate a float or that kind of thing, anyone who's been there, I mean, it's a parody of parades. It's not like a traditional parade. They kind of like are spoofing the very idea of parades. But if you're willing to go out and kind of clown around, they are accepting applications, but no later than 4:02 a.m. on July 21st at the Whiting Robertsdale Chamber of Commerce there on 119th Street. So if you're a night owl or early morning person, you could really, you know, get your application at the last minute to Tavarshed Pierogi Fest. It's always obviously a good time. You see a lot of wacky satire and so forth. But it'll be coming back. It's the biggest summer festival we have in the region. We have a lot of other ones. We have the Greek and Surf Fest. We have Festival of the Lakes. We have a lot of festivals in this area. St. Thomas War Fest at Munster is coming back. A lot of it is going to be returning this year. But this is easily the biggest. Hundreds of thousands of people attend. It gets, people from all over Chicagoland. The former CBS meteorologist is the Grand Marshal of the parade. It just gets a lot of, gotten a lot of coverage internationally. It's been in the Wall Street Journal, TripAdvisor. Oprah's called it one of her favorite, festivals. But it will be back in at least the modified form this year.
Well, Joseph Pete, thank you very much for talking about not only the Pierogi Fest parade and the event itself and all the other stories that you've had out there in print and online in the Times. And we'll have you back on again soon. Thanks very much.
So much for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Last month, one healthcare system in Northwest Indiana announced it will be dramatically downsizing a hospital that serves a large minority population, many of whom lack healthcare insurance. And now there's concern that a neighboring hospital could do the same, and at least two Indiana lawmakers are trying to get some answers to the issues. Michael Puente tells us more.
6 months ago, Earl Harris Jr. began hearing things about St. Catherine Hospital. It's located just over the state line in East Chicago, Indiana.
I started having people reach out to me in the community saying, hey, we've heard rumors. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this?
This is everything from downsizing, closing, or changing the primary focus of St. Catherine Hospital. The hospital, Northwest Indiana's only five-star hospital, serves a predominantly Black and Latino community, many who are on Medicaid and some with no health insurance at all. As an Indiana state representative, Harris gets a lot of calls from concerned residents, and those calls have only increased. That's because last month, the operators of Franciscan Health Hammond announced that the bed space there will decrease from over 200 to just 8, causing public outrage. But if reducing services at that hospital wasn't bad enough, the question swirling around St. Catherine is causing more angst.
If someone lives here in East Chicago and has a stroke and there's not a local hospital here, that's additional time it will take to go to a hospital in Gary. That's the difference between life and death.
Harris reached out to St. Catherine Hospital CEO Leo Carrera back in December. Carrera assured him of the hospital's future, but questions still kept coming to Harris. Harris reached out again just a couple of months ago.
Hey, people are still talking. Here's a suggestion. What if the hospital, put out a statement making it clear there are no plans to close the hospital, there are no plans to make it into a psych hospital? That would go a long way in calming the community's fears.
Harris never got a response. It's silence like that that's led to fear in the community, including among doctors like Paula Benchik-Abrinko.
I'm not privy to talk amongst administration, but the hospital appears to be in the process of being disassembled.
Dr. Benchik-Abrinko has been an attending physician at St. Catherine Hospital since the 90s and also works at its sister facility, Community Hospital, 11 miles away in Munster, Indiana. She says a number of staff at St. Catherine Hospital have been let go in recent months, including its infectious disease coordinator, emergency department director, and head of its cardiology department. Some services are also being sent to Community Hospital.
Strokes are not treated there. If a stroke shows up at the hospital, they are sent to Munster. They used to give chemotherapy and treat people for, say, leukemia. Now that has been taken to Munster.
St. Catherine Hospital is operated by Community Foundation of Northwest Indiana, a three-hospital system based in Munster. It declined to make St. Catherine CEO Leo Carrera available for an interview. In a statement, a spokesman says the healthcare system is investing in St. Catherine Hospital, including making improvements to its cancer care, behavioral health services, diabetes care, and other areas. But these statements stand in direct contrast to what a half dozen physicians or staff have told WBEZ over the last several months, Some declined to speak on the record for fear of retaliation. Dr. Kim Arthur, an OBGYN who once served as president of the medical staff at St. Catherine Hospital, says not only are personnel leaving, so are services.
A lot of these patients are being directed towards community hospitals. It's a big concern because now the patients are being left with very few choices. They have to look outside of their community.
According to the Indiana State Department of Health, St. Catherine Hospital has cut its full-time staff by 180 over the last 3 years. Records show it also generates much less revenue as compared to its two sister hospitals, including Community Hospital, both located in more affluent areas. Because St. Catherine Hospital is located in a high-minority, low-income community, it's considered a safety net hospital. And those types of hospitals have been impacted by the pandemic, says Beth Fedpush of America's Essentials Hospitals Organization.
The community has been harder hit. The patients have been harder hit. But the workforce has been as well. And they were on slim financial footing before the pandemic. They continue to struggle.
Hospitals are not there to make money anyway. And they got all kinds of different governmental programs, especially with Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement process.
That's longtime Indiana State Senator Lonnie Randolph, whose office is down the street from the hospital.
I'm hoping that the suggestion that Representative Harris made concerning a public statement will go a long way toward cut down on the rumors and maybe eliminate them completely and everything.
To find answers, Hoosiers will have an additional tool coming July 1st. That's when a new state law goes into effect in Indiana, requiring all not-for-profit hospitals, including St. Catherine Hospital, to schedule an annual public meeting to meet with the communities they serve. I'm Michael Puente.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Thanks to the guests, and I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.